Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The spring of 1862 marked a ratcheting of Civil War tensions between the Union capital, Washington, D.C., and the Confederate seat of power in Richmond, Virginia, which was helped in no small part by their relative proximity. Union General George McClellan would make an attempt to capture the Confederate government and army base during his Springtime Peninsula campaign. It would end in failure by July after a string of six fierce and bloody fights known as the Seven Days Battle. McClellan's inability to take Richmond in this campaign allowed the war to continue for years. All the while this campaign was going on, spies from both the North and the South were doing their parts to aid their causes and thwart the efforts of their opponents. A new historical novel tells the tale of one of these subversive plots, and it's up to a young Union artillery lieutenant and a grizzled New York journalist to stop it. Richmond's Bloody Road is written by Milwaukee author Thomas Martin Saturday, or as Lake Effect listeners might know him, Thomas Martin Sabotke. He's the voice of our Civil War series. Sabotke tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why he turned to fiction even as he remained true to history.
At one point, I decided I wanted to have our characters in the first novel uncover two Confederate double agents who worked out of Richmond. And I was digging around for background in some books about Union intelligence and found there were two Confederate double agents that were found out. So the facts of history actually met fiction 100% dead on. And that kind of staggered me. So I have to be careful that I don't, in creating a fictional story, run into real history too much.
Well, tell us where we are, at what point in the war we are at the beginning of Richmond's Bloody Road.
Yeah, this is just before the Union Army of the Potomac with George McClellan is finally going to move out of Washington, D.C. Over 100,000 men. It's March of 1862. In the West, there is some success going on with Grant at Fort Donelson and, you know, and so on, and Shiloh's weeks away. But in the East, things have not been going well at all, and McClellan has done really nothing. And All Quiet on the Potomac becomes a hit song because they're not doing much. And then, of course, the two characters that are the prime characters in what will be a series of novels meet in rather unusual circumstances.
Well, let's talk about your two protagonists. I want to start with Benjamin Eaton. Did you want to make him representative of your average Union soldier? Or was he kind of a composite of a few different figures you had in mind, or totally made out of whole cloth?
He would be a composite, but he was I wanted to have a young officer who would be with one of the classes of 1861 at West Point, who either were thrown right out into the Army into a Great War, you know, right as soon as they graduated, or had their last year cut short and were sent out there. And Eaton's character is really that stoic character where he's always going to do his duty. He really is fearless for his life. Devoted to the Union all the way, but he has an unusual background. His family's really from Tidewater, Maryland, right across the Potomac from Virginia. And in his grandfather's generation, they owned some slaves. And his manner of speech is a Virginia drawl. And in fact, the rest of his family is in Fairfax County across the Potomac. And they are slaveholders still. And there's been an estrangement. And he constantly has to fight with people who think somehow he shouldn't be in the Union Army because he sounds so Southern and he's wearing blue. And he is in the regular artillery. He's a regular and he's commanding that little bit of the regular United States Army that existed at the beginning of the Civil War, not volunteers. So he's a thoroughgoing professional and he has this place within him, though, is a great weakness, just like any great character would in a Greek tragedy almost. And that is that at Henry House Hill, he was with his battery as a lieutenant, and all six guns were historically taken. They were Ricketts' battery, and he had a horrible experience in that battle, and it shakes him to the core, and he's fighting in command of Union troops in any battle with that memory. It just, you know, these recurring dreams and the savagery of it all. And it's something he has to overcome. But otherwise, he's that stock character that reins in my other character somehow.
Speaking of reining in other characters, I believe that would apply most appropriately to Sanford Ellis. He is a reporter out of New York. I know you just had an article published on war correspondence. How much did you draw on that for modeling this character, Sanford Ellis?
Well, I've studied a great deal about the war correspondence in the Civil War. I certainly did model Sanford Ellis after, again, a composite of a lot of reporters. I just made him more irresponsible than most. That's part of the problem. He's from Boston, and he's a Boston Brahmin, Harvard-educated, lives on Beacon Street, on Beacon Hill. He drops names all over the place. He is a thoroughgoing womanizer, a cad of the worst type.
And a drunk.
And a drunk, yes. He likes alcohol, and he gets drunk when he has not a whole lot to do. It's odd. He ended up going to work for the New York Herald newspaper, and he is a thoroughgoing unionist, but he's also an abolitionist. And the New York Herald is Tammany Hall Democrat and very sympathetic to the Southern situation. And one of the fascinating things is that here he's working for a newspaper that is completely opposite editorially from what he believes. But he explains early in the book that, well, he was looking for some sort of job, and that was the one that was open at the time.
So how did these two characters from such different parts of the country with such different attitudes and kind of personalities, how did they get thrown together?
Well, they're both in the same Washington, D.C. bordello at the same time. That's pretty much it. A place called Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies.
Uh-huh.
But the education that these women have is distinctly, shall we say, illegal. Of course, this is a place full of cigar smoke, clanking glasses, and it's just a wild place. There were hundreds of these bordellos that sprang up in Washington as soon as the Civil War began. I know it's rather scandalous. Most people don't want to talk about that, but that would be the truth. And in fact, 13th and D Streets was about the worst neighborhood for these things. And today, I believe the Smithsonian Institution has taken over that property, if I'm not mistaken. So that's kind of, if you're walking through some of the newer parts of the Smithsonian, you may be walking over my fictional Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies. But they have a fight. They literally get to it. And one of the things that staggers Ellis is that this young artillery lieutenant is able to get him up against a wall with his hand on his throat, and in a position where this little much smaller lieutenant, he didn't think this guy has this kind of a starch behind him. And they both kind of have a truce and decide that it's not worth the fighting over. And they leave the bordello only to hear the barking of a dog from in back.
And that's when they discover this dead body right near the restrooms, if you will.
That's right. Out on the woodpile is a man in a black frock coat who is obviously dead. And as the body is being examined by Sanford Ellis, Ellis tells him that he's done a lot of what's called night work. Apparently before the war, as a reporter, they stuck him on the police beat, which a paper like the New York Herald really made its money as a tabloid almost. They liked to cover murders and all kinds of seamy underbelly kind of stories for New York City. So he's had a lot of experience actually running down murders and many other things, and he's worked with what sad excuses there were in those days for police departments. And he is a bit of a sleuth.
Now, as we follow these two characters as they're investigating this murder and finding out that it has more and more to do with the Confederate cause, we meet a series of characters that at first present themselves as the complete opposite of what they end up being. And I'm immediately thinking of Sarah.
Sarah is apparently to Eaton's command. They come in the dark while they're in the Virginia Peninsula later in that year when the army has moved and is trying to capture Richmond in the summer of 1862. And Sarah has brought a little boy to freedom, but she has a message for any Union unit she can find that is rather startling. But I had an awareness that I wanted to have some African-American characters that during the war were doing a lot more on their own initiative, which would have been actually for at least a portion of the African-American community in Richmond. True, there were African-Americans who were aiding the Union as the war developed. There were those who were running away. But there was also a group of free blacks in Richmond who, although they were considered inferior to any white person, were carving out niches for themselves. And I wanted these characters to have the abilities and initiative and having a sense of their own identities that would really run counter to what people would assume slaves would be.
Now, Sarah helps bring Ellis and Eaton into the company of the Dandridge sisters, and I want to have you talk a little bit about these characters and what role they end up playing in this mystery that they're trying to solve.
Sarah's been sent out to find them because these two Richmond Confederate ladies want to help the Union cause. And of course, our two main characters, when they meet the Dandridge sisters, find that they're both under 30, both extremely attractive, and they're especially drawn to Elizabeth Dandridge, who runs counter to a lot of things that would be a Confederate lady of Richmond at that time. I really got onto the Dandridge sisters from history. There was a real person named Elizabeth Van Loo, who gave enormous amounts of intelligence through the lines to the Union side as the war progressed. She was actually living in a mansion on Grace Street in Richmond. That's where I have their mansion with her mother. But I just changed that and I made the other person a sibling. And I guess you're trying to figure out, well, how would these women hide their Union proclivities? And of course, what they do is that Elizabeth, the way she does it is that she is such a feminist, such a suffragist, that and so independent and fierce that a lot of the gentlemen of Richmond who would want to marry such a beautiful woman just, you know, can't stand her. And so that's her way of doing it. Jenny hides her Union proclivities by being the opposite of her sister, so conventional. But she has an illness, you know, that limits her marriage prospects. And they do have a heart, these women. They are very strong in collecting money for Confederate soldiers who are wounded. And that's a real humanitarian thing that they sincerely are devoted to. The way Elizabeth Van Loo stayed out of trouble was she also cultivated an image. She was like the Dandridges. She did help any Union prisoners as well as Confederate men who were ill. But she was known as something like Crazy Mary. She kind of acted a little strange in public. And so if she had said something or done something that might look like she was disloyal, people actually put it off to, well, she's nuts. Don't worry about it. And she actually got through a lot of it, particularly at the end of the war, with that reputation.
Were there spies who actually were able to get behind the lines at Richmond to be on the Confederate side, Union spies like Ellis and Eaton end up pretty much becoming?
Yes, there were spies on both sides getting into Washington. I think the infiltration of our nation's capital on the Union side, Washington, D.C., was a lot more extensive. The Confederates were much more successful because that city, Washington, was really just across the Potomac from Virginia. And most people that lived in Washington all through the war were born and bred Southerners. And in fact, John Hay, Lincoln's secretary, noted in his diary that any time a Union defeat was announced, you would hear Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag on pianos up and down the streets of Washington as hundreds, if not thousands, of Washingtonians celebrated every Confederate victory. So if you're Abraham Lincoln or you're anybody in Washington on the Union side, you become aware very quickly of the fact that the enemy is in your midst and how many of those people who are openly celebrating Union defeats would be excellent choices for espionage, and there were many.
Well, so what's next for Ellis and Eaton?
Well, my next novel is entitled The Lamentations of Uriah. This is a continuation of this problem with General McClellan and certain generals around him. And if the first novel had a secret or piece of information that could turn the direction of the war, this will be dwarfed by what appears in the second novel. And much to my surprise, when I did the historical background research I wanted to do, it actually fits my novel plot that I put together that I thought was so wild and crazy. And really what it is, it's taking what really was the case and just turning it up at one little slight notch further than historically was true. It's real close to what could have happened.
Well, Thomas Martin Sabaki, thanks for coming in and sharing Richmond's Bloody Road with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thomas Martin Saturday's first historical novel in the Ellis Eaton series is Richmond's Bloody Road, published by Moving Train Books. The second book will be published in the coming months. Saturday is the pen name of our own Civil War correspondent Thomas Martin Sabaki. You can listen in on Lake Effect Weekend to hear him discuss the impact of Gettysburg. Coming up next, the amazing Milwaukee race on bikes turns two this year. We'll hear about this year's race next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.